Welcome to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides with Anna Staver, an hour celebrating people whose passion, creativity, and dedication can inspire us all. This hour, we're going to be hearing from a national journalist covering the Democratic Convention in Chicago, a former editor who built a museum dedicated to American road signs, and a woman who practices spiritual reading. Three different people from three different walks of life tied together by a common thread, our great state of Ohio. And we begin at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, when Vice President Kamala Harris formally accepts her party's nomination tonight. Ohio native Chris Jansing will be watching. Born in Fairport Harbor, Ohio, Jansing is the anchor of MSNBC's Chris Jansing Reports. Welcome to All Sides.
It's so great to be here, Anna. Thank you so much for having me.
It's been quite a week for the Democrats with a lot of somewhat surprising star power taking the stage. I have to ask, I think people experience the convention differently depending on how you watch it. So people who get clips on social media get one impression. People like myself this year who are watching it on television get another. But I'm curious, for someone who's there, who's seeing the crowd in real time, what have been the most energizing, exciting moments?
So I think it won't surprise you to hear, right, that anytime Kamala Harris has been seen, whether she is on stage or she surprised people and came out that first night, or even when she has been seen on video, the place goes absolutely wild. But what I have never seen before, and my first convention, was I graduated from Otterbein, at the time college, now university in Westerville, so not far from where you're sitting. And my first convention was in 1980 in New York City. So I have some experience with this. And I've talked to a lot of people who have been to many conventions. I just talked to a guy who was at his fourth convention. And I've been to both, right, Republican and Democratic conventions. This is different. And the feeling in the room is different. And I think there's a couple of things that are going on. One that is, just a month ago, a lot of Democrats were feeling dispirited at best, despondent at worst, wondering how it was ever going to be possible to win. And then what really, I think, even though you might say, well, we talked about it, we knew it might be coming, the decision by President Biden to step down was such a game changer. But more than that, they've had 3 weeks leading up to this convention where it seems she hasn't made a real misstep, that she's only been building. They're collecting record amounts of money. The polls are moving in her direction, although making the mistake, this is still a very tight race. So on the floor, and I think it is reflected on television, there's a joyfulness, to steal a word from the campaign, that people here are feeling.
Yeah, Oprah, even last night, used the word pretty explicitly, the joy of what is unfolding. I do want to ask you a bit about your childhood here in Ohio. You're one of 12 children, which, oh my goodness, I cannot imagine. I am the fifth of six, so large family, but yours was double in size. How has that shaped the woman that you ended up becoming?
Well, first, I think is growing up in an area of Ohio that is ethnic and where there were a lot of, frankly, big families. You, as a kid, you only know what you know, right? So even though we had the biggest family in town, and Fairport Harbor is a small town, I think it was 4,000 when I grew up there, and my graduating class was 56 people. When you're a kid, you don't know anything different. And ultimately, I think that those values that you get when you live in a small town, and a town of 4,000 people where there are seven churches, and where people worked in the factory. My dad worked in the factory. My mother worked in a bakery where the idea was implanted in you that the way to success was education. And that, to me, growing up in suburban Cleveland, going to suburban Columbus seemed very exotic because we didn't take vacations. I wasn't in a lot of different places. So for me, I think it grounded me in a way that is very familiar to a lot of people in America, which is small town, hardworking, somewhere in their background, a memory of a relative, in my case, my grandfather, who came over and saw Ellis Island, and his records are still there. In 1898, he came over and came to work on the railroad in Ohio. So for me, it's about all of that. It's also about, if I can be very personal for a minute, having nothing to do with politics, that I cannot shake the feeling that before I die, the Cleveland Browns will win the Super Bowl.
Ooh, that is a big wish.
Tell me about it.
I know. My father was a huge New York Jets fan and a huge New York Mets fan. And when he passed, as was his wish, we put Jets and Mets, I could wait no longer, on the back of his headstone.
Oh. Well, that's a thought for me, actually. But I still have a little time.
Yeah. So you went to Otterbein, but you didn't start out as a journalism major. You were studying political science. What made you make the switch?
You know, there was a gubernatorial campaign the year that I first was involved in politics. And it's funny how, for me, I guess it never occurred to me really to be a journalist. First of all, even in local news back then, there were often two anchors on the local news desk, but they were two men. Mm. And women were, quote unquote, weather girls. And I think I didn't have any example out there of what it was to be a journalist. And yet, I think because my father was very conscious of the fact that he had, as he called it, a single-digit education. He went to work after the ninth grade to help support his own family. He had 10 brothers and sisters. That the idea that I could do what I do now absolutely never occurred to me. But because of my dad, we got daily newspapers. We talked about the news as a family. We sat down, which sounds so old-fashioned, but we sat down as a family and watched the news at 6:30 every night. And some of my most vivid memories are of my dad getting involved in local politics. One of my brothers eventually became a city council member. So that was always sort of roiling in the background. It wasn't really until, and this is how happenstance things can be, I was at Otterbein. An upperclassman asked me if I could do a news shift for her at the WOBN Otterbein radio station. And I said, I don't know anything about news. And she said, it's okay. The disc jockey is there. You'll print off some scripts. You'll read them when he points to you. And that's it. Can you read?
I said, oh, my goodness.
Yes, I can read. And it's such a strange thing, Anna. I did it. It was a Friday night. She had a date. She didn't want to do her shift. And I knew in that moment, and I've never looked back, I literally knew in that moment. I went in on Monday. I changed my major and have not looked back all these years later. And I graduated in 1978 from Otterbein.
You won an Emmy Award in 1997 for your coverage of the Olympic Park bombing in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And that had to be incredibly difficult to cover. And I wonder, do you think the news industry has gotten better over your years in it at supporting journalists who cover difficult topics?
Oh, a lot better. And I've done a lot of very difficult stories. Someone here in the hall asked me the other day, they remembered that I had covered Columbine, and I've covered more than a dozen mass shootings, many of them at school, Newtown. When you go someplace where a bunch of elementary school kids have just lost their lives, it's something that impacts you, right? And I've been to war zones, and I've, ducked behind tanks. And I happened to be in Israel covering a story on a day when there was a bombing at a university where Americans were killed. And that day I had scheduled an interview with the head of Hamas, and Hamas had claimed responsibility for the bombing. So I've been in all sorts of situations. And I think today what we know is that there are very difficult repercussions for a lot of people. I know people who, for example, were at the attempted assassination of Donald Trump, and they have a form of, I'm not a clinician, I don't want to pretend to know their diagnosis, but they are suffering from what they are told is PTSD. And back then, they would ask you if you needed a day off or did you need time off? Now they have really a setup for folks who need often, just to take a little time, need to talk to someone. That has changed, I think, dramatically from when I started in this business. My first job was at, the first paying job I ever had, Anna, was at the Westerville Public Opinion. I can't remember. I think they paid me $10. And my very first story, I was in the Westerville City Council meeting, which was the proverbial smoke-filled room, and it ended up on the front page. And that was it. I thought my career could never get any better than that. So, I think it's changed. Obviously, technologically, my business has changed in a breathtaking way. But in the understanding of what people go through, it's changed dramatically.
Coming from Ohio, I wonder how you handle when Ohio politicians make news. Obviously, Sherrod Brown is running a very competitive U.S. Senate race this year, and J.D. Vance, he's the Republican vice presidential nominee. He talks a lot about growing up in Ohio, being from southwestern Ohio, his family struggling with addiction. How does your own lived experience here impact that?
You know, I remember, and I haven't had time to go back to it, but I remember reading his book when it first came out. And I remember feeling, okay, we had some of the same experiences in terms of, you know, growing up in a house where finances were challenged. But I think my assessment of the people I grew up with was probably different than the people he grew up with. What I will say is this. What Ohio does for me, besides obviously my lived experience having, you know, grown up there and really never going anywhere else, but also most of my family is still there. Many of my brothers and sisters still live there. I have 23 nieces and nephews and more than 30 great nieces and nephews, and most of them live there. And they're texting me a lot about what they're hearing. For example, one of them who's a teacher, right? Always very interested in educational issues. Now you have a teacher who's vice president. They're calling me and asking me, what's going to happen with the Senate race? And the only thing I can tell them is yesterday I had Gary Peters, who's the head of the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, on. And I asked him specifically about Sherrod Brown. And I didn't get what I would call a direct answer. He said, because the question is money, right? Because right. What they provide is money. And he said there are going to be 6 or 7 races that he thinks they'll support. He's a very data-driven guy. And he said, we're going to put our money where we get the best bang. And what they found in the last cycle, when I think they surprised a lot of people by, winning control of the Senate, even though it's, you know, it's pretty equal, is that they put a lot of money in at the end. They waited to see where they thought they had the enthusiasm. And if I can tie that to where I am sitting right now, which is in Chicago, I think a lot of these delegates are going to go home. The Ohio delegation may not get a lot of attention because they're not a battleground state, but they're going to go home and they're going to start the work. And I think a lot of what they bring back and what they produce for Sherrod Brown may help to inform what some others on the national level do in terms of his race.
Yeah, I think there's lots of reasons that Tim Ryan didn't beat J.D. Vance in 2022, but one of them was money. The polling in the race showed a dead heat in August, and then Mitch McConnell came in with a whole bunch of money, and the Democrats nationally did not. Now, they put their money in Georgia and Pennsylvania, and arguably those were the correct calls, but Vance won, but he won by, I think, 18 points less than Governor Mike DeWine won.
Yeah, there was definitely an opportunity there for Tim Ryan, and money could have filled in the blank. He also, I think if you look at some of the postmortems, he was considered a really strong candidate. He's a very good speaker. He has great on the stump skills. He relates very well to people and he knows the state. So, look, everybody who doesn't get the money, in my experience, always believes, whether they win or not, that the wrong decision was made. But there is data that tells you, both in real time and after the fact, or at least informs you in a very strong way. Maybe there's nothing 100% clear, but it informs you in a really strong way. And, if I were a Sherrod Brown or a Marcy Kaptur, who obviously, as her race is one of those that falls into redistricting, Amelia Sykes in the Akron-Canton area. Some of the really tough races were Democrats. And I can tell you that there is a lot of conversation on the national level about those kinds of races and a lot of decisions that are going to have to be made.
The final question for you is perhaps the wrong one to ask the week of the Democratic National Convention, but how are you keeping up with the breakneck pace of news? Because I'm tired just sitting here in Ohio.
Wow, that's such a great question. I'll say, first of all, that genetically, I come from a family with ridiculous stores of energy, and I'm grateful for that. I can take absolutely no credit for it. I can't say that I'm like someone who has a routine. I work with people who are great about how they eat and when they sleep and working out. I'm sorry, but if I can go back to my room and take a half an hour nap or go to the gym, there's a pretty good chance that I'm going to take the nap. But look, this is a whole new world. And I have a lot of young people on my team at Christiansing Reports, and they ask me about this. And I tell them, I have been doing this for 40 years. I was on the air 7 hours a day after 9/11. I was anchoring from 5 a.m. to noon every day for months. And we went to war. I was on, and I was working on weekends. And, you know, I had a few weekends off recently where the first weekend I got a phone call and there had been an assassination attempt on Donald Trump. And so I went into work that weekend. And then the next weekend, Joe Biden stepped out of the race. And then he supported Kamala Harris. And so I worked that weekend. And before I knew all that was going to happen, I had already made an agreement to do a 100-day to the election special. And so you do those things. And I don't mean to sound Pollyannish or small town Ohio, but I am so cognizant of the fact that this is a gift to be able to do what I love to do, to have an opportunity to travel to these places, to talk to people who are in positions of power or making news, or even, as I did yesterday, a 95-year-old delegate from Pennsylvania who has served on her town's Democratic committee for 66 years. She was an inspiration. That's what keeps my energy going. And I'm just grateful. I'm grateful I've been able to do this as long as I have, to see the things that I've been able to see, to talk to the people that I've been able to talk to, and basically be paid for having an understanding of what's happening in the world. So if you're asking me, do I complain sometimes? I'm not going to lie to you. Sometimes I do. But mostly I'm just profoundly humbled by the idea that people turn on their TV during the day and count on me to give them the news. And I should also say that I'm a big believer in local newspapers. I used to read you in the Columbus Dispatch. You're a fine, fine reporter. And so I appreciate the question because I know you know what it takes to do this job. And, you know, we're just lucky.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I fell in love with it and I never looked back.
Isn't that something?
How many
people can say that?
Yeah. It is quite something to get to truly love the thing that you do. That was Chris Jansing, the anchor of MSNBC's Chris Jansing Reports. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, and go Brown.
Coming up, the history of American signs is on display in Cincinnati. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Drive along any highway after dark, and the horizon is dotted with glowing neon signs, beacons in the night advertising food, gas, hotels. To Tom Swarmstead, these road signs are more than advertisements. They're pieces of American history, an often overlooked part of our culture that hides right here in plain sight. That's why he built the American Sign Museum in Cincinnati, home to the largest public collection of signs in the country. Tom, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, good morning.
Where did your fascination with American signage begin?
Well, actually, I wrote for a magazine called Signs of the Times. It's a trade magazine for the sign industry. I worked in that magazine about 27, 28 years, but it actually dates to May 1906 was the first issue, and my great-grandfather was the editor. So I come through it, I guess, through my genes or whatever, because it's been in a family business since May of 1906.
And so you work for this Sign of the Times magazine, which I will admit I had no idea the publication existed before we started preparing for this show. Mm-hmm. When did you start collecting the signs?
Well, everybody thinks because I founded the museum in 99 that I was always a collector of signs. I am a collector. I do have that obsession. Not a hoarder. I'm just a collector. I didn't really, I collected a few beer signs, but I actually started on the museum in 1999. I was still working at the magazine, got some seed money from the family to actually start on the museum. We incorporated in 99, and then in 2001, we got our 501c3 status.
Yeah, online you describe it as your midlife crisis.
Well, yeah, that just... Probably being a little cute there, but so I started working on 72 now. So I started working on it when you do have a midlife crisis. I always joke that I could probably have done works with a midlife crisis project.
Yeah. So you start collecting these signs and you decide you're going to open this American Sign Museum. But you hadn't planned on it being in Cincinnati. You were looking in Memphis, Las Vegas, New York. How did we land here in the Gem City?
Well, quite honestly, I was a magazine publisher. I'd never tried to start a museum. You know, I had to learn through the school of hard knocks. But I thought where would be a good place for a sign museum. I thought West Coast, Los Angeles, which is kind of to me the home of pop culture. I thought of New York. And you think of the New York is the home of advertising signs or a form of advertising. Then I thought about Chicago. It's in my mind, it's a very strong area in design, particularly graphic design. I actually thought of Las Vegas as well, obviously, because it's the sign mecca. All of those places I researched, there were some things happening in LA that were conducive. There was a Museum of Neon Art, which I thought I might collaborate with. Las Vegas, there was a fledgling neon museum in Las Vegas. The Memphis thing, I thought, Beale Street would be, if you think about Beale Street and the bars and you think about jazz and blues and neon signs are a part of that, all of those things. So I was shopping my museum around. It was not very, there wasn't a lot. It was more of a concept than it was an actual entity at the time. And, there's this crazy long haired bearded guy with this crazy idea. I thought I needed to land somewhere and actually open up. I had built a prototype in Las Vegas, actually, in conjunction with a big sign convention out there. So anyways, I brought everything back to Cincinnati and opened in the humble beginnings of, I think it was about 4,200 square feet in an old factory that was home to a lot of artists. We were kind of the anchor tenant there, I guess. And I opened in April 2005. I just thought I'd been talking about this for so long, 5, 6 years. I had to land somewhere and actually have a physical space to come to.
So speaking of the physical space, the one you have now is listed on the National Register of Historic Places.
Well, it's actually the building is
Yeah.
it was the home of Fashion Frocht, which is probably isn't well known to your audience, but Fashion Frocht was the first women's clothing line sold door to door, and
Oh.
they opened here in the 20s. The buildings prior to that was a factory creating bindery equipment. So Fashion Frocht's opened in the 20s. They were here 20 years, and then in the war years, they converted to a parachute factory. They could sew clothing. They could sew parachutes. So for the 4 main years of World War II, I guess 41 to 45, it was a parachute factory, and then it converted back to clothing. And they survived till the 72, 73, 74. I can't actually find the exact date, but the early 70s.
Do you have any signage from Fashion Frocks or any of the previous iterations of the building?
The only really good picture I was able to find at the Historical Society here was there was a flood in Cincinnati in the 30s, 37, and I was able to find a picture of the building underwater, but it was an aerial shot, and it was the building's 40,000 square feet, but it wasn't a big part of the picture. It was just kind of a
I gotcha.
over in the corner. We do have some posters. Actually, they're scans of posters from Fashion Frocks. We actually have a couple of pieces of clothing that were produced by Fashion Frocks.
So, for the rest of the museum, I want to talk a little bit about what someone would see if they came down to visit. I guess how many signs do you have? What's the largest? What's the smallest?
Well, I should explain also that it's not only signs that we have, but we have sign making equipment, materials, tools. We have a large archive of books, instructional books, books on how to bend neon, how to paint
Oh,
signs.
neat.
We have a picture archive. We have artwork, blueprints, sign sketches, and probably most importantly of all, we have a complete collection of Signs of the Times magazines. The family had the foresight to, at the end of each year, they would take one issue from each month and hard bind that from the very beginning. So we have that. I know the Library of Congress has a lot of issues, but I don't know if they have a complete collection. So it's an incredible archive. But signs wise, I think signs on display, probably 400 or 500 signs, and that can range from we have a McDonald's sign from Huntsville, Alabama, 1963. It weighs just short of 10, excuse me, of 2 tons. And it stands about 25 feet tall, and it's
You don't realize on the road
20
how
feet
big those
wide.
golden arches are.
Exactly. Even I have been around signs for a while. If we acquire a sign, I see it up in the air, and I see, I know it's 12 feet. I go, 12 feet, that's something we can handle. It gets down on the ground, I go, oh, that's 12 feet. It's just something, you think about signs, they're everywhere, but people don't think that someone's got to design the sign, somebody's got to create the sign, build the sign, fabricate the sign, install the sign, and somebody's got to maintain the sign. So if people come here and they leave with a new appreciation for the people that actually design, build, and install signs, then we've accomplished our mission to some degree. So smallest sign, would be probably a sign that was inside a store. It might, I think probably the smallest sign I might be 2 by 3 inches or so. But we have a lot of other items, like as I said, that are not signs. We have a miniature Holiday Inn pin that would have gone on a lapel of a jacket. I mean, so we have objects that's as small as that.
Do you have any personal favorites?
I get asked that question a lot. I think probably when people think of a sign museum, they think of neon signs. And I certainly love neon, but I actually appreciate the period before neon, the period of light bulb signs. The neon really hit the US in the late 20s, but the period before that, the only form of illumination was light bulbs, and that's probably turn of the century, 1900, up until the late 20s. It's just that the craftsmanship in making these large electric signs, it was a time in the States, in the U.S., when there was we had our own industrial revolution. There were a lot of patented and trademark products and fabrication. I just really appreciate the craftsmanship. This is back at a time when they didn't have a CNC routers and that kind of thing. Everything was fabricated by hand. Signs were installed with a pulley system. They didn't have crane trucks. And then it's, I also like what I would probably call the funkier signs. Some of the signs from the 50s. We have a rotating globe with 11 spikes in it, kind of like a Sputnik-like sign. It was from Anaheim, California shopping center, built in this in 62. Satellite Shopland was the name of the shopping center, so it kind of reflects that Jetsons period of the late 50s after Sputnik was launched, and there was this big, interest in outer space, rocket ships, planets. So that's a really, really fun sign.
You have a big boy, iconic hamburger
Well,
guy.
we actually have two big boys. We have a big boy from the local franchise, which is called Frisch's, which is headquartered in Cincinnati, but goes east to Wheeling, up to Columbus, Indiana, and south Lexington, Louisville. But we also have a version that's from Michigan, and he's actually rotating. It's he's much larger than our other big boy. He's part of our expansion.
So he's a bigger big boy.
He's a bigger big boy, yes, ma'am.
Is the museum ever available for special events?
We actually, I knew, I wasn't, I had never done museums, but I'm a kind of a business guy, and I thought about how to keep a not-for-profit alive. We rely on what we call private events as a revenue stream. It's probably not quite half of our annual revenue. So we do weddings, and we do customer appreciation parties, holiday parties, bar mitzvahs. We've
It'd
done.
be a cool place for a party.
It's a bright and colorful, very upbeat place for a party, and you don't need any decorations.
For regular folks visiting, what hours are you open?
Our regular hours are Wednesday through Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4. We're closed Monday and Tuesday, but we often push, if we have a bus tour coming in, we often try to push them to Monday or Tuesday, because the arrival of 50 people all at once kind of upsets the normal traffic flow. So yeah, Wednesday through Sunday, 10 to 4 is our regular hours.
Is there a entry fee?
There is an entry fee. $20 is regular admission. Kids 12 and under are free. Let's see. Members of the armed forces or retired, it's $10. Seniors our 10. Yeah, so that's our, and then we have group rates for
For
when
big
there's a group
tours.
tour. Yeah, group tours of, I think it's 10 or more.
That was Tom Swarmstedt, a collector of signs whose passion resulted in the creation of the American Sign Museum in Cincinnati. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, a journalism professor's quest to share spiritual reading with the world. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast, female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides, an hour celebrating people whose passion, creativity, and dedication can inspire us all. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Professor Gene Kelly has always found comfort in the pages of a book, a place to escape to, or a companion to sit with. Then she discovered that reading could be its own kind of prayer. Hooked by the ancient spiritual discipline of spiritual reading, Kelly began a daily practice that would lead her back to herself, one page at a time. She shares her new journey in her new book, Less Helping Them, More Healing You, The Transcendental Gift of an Ancient Spiritual Practice. Professor Kelly, welcome to All Sides.
Anna, thank you for this opportunity.
I want to start by asking the obvious question, what is spiritual reading?
Well, the difficult Latin way to talk about it is Lectio Divina, and it even has Latin names for all the steps. But as you mentioned, I call it in the book spiritual reading, and it is ancient in that it was really formalized into a meditative technique in the 6th century, and it's maintained its value to people today. And because it's very simple, very flexible, very forgiving. And I believe it's something that, regardless of your faith or your beliefs, it's accessible to everyone as an opportunity for meditation and contemplation because it's four simple steps.
And obviously, I'm going to ask you, what are the four simple steps?
Okay, so they are read, reflect, respond, and receive. And I actually, in the book, break those down into even smaller steps and provide examples of how I used them and used those steps in my life and the gifts I found through the process of using this in regular practice in my life. And those are the four steps. And I like to say that I learned this 10 years ago and more than that, probably. And through regular practice, kind of began to understand that I needed the pace it offers, which is slower. You usually take at least half an hour to walk through those steps. And I needed the space. I felt like I finally began to understand that I deserve that space to myself for meditation and the time to go through a text with those four steps. And then I discovered grace in that moment or in that time, which to me is just an openness and a recognition of the divine.
How did you discover the practice?
Well, actually, I went to a retreat at my church in Sunbury, Ohio, St. John Newman. And but I think the hook was reading can be prayer. I'm in, right?
I'm a big reader myself. So yeah, it's immediately intriguing if you're somebody who loves to read.
Right. And so the other aspect of that those four steps, the read, reflect, respond, receive, that fourth step, that respond to a text that you select, and I can talk a little bit about what the text, what that means. Often for me, it's writing. And so as a journalist and been writing since I was a child making books, right? That I've always thought that creative act is always a collaboration with a collective consciousness or the divine or God. And so that was something I really needed at a very difficult time in my life. And sometimes that what I wrote was even a prayer.
Yeah, you have this quote in the book from Flannery O'Connor that I loved. Ah, you're nodding. You know what I'm going to say.
Yes.
The quote was, "I write because I don't know what I think until I read what I say."
Right. Because I think there was a time, especially I was going through a very difficult domestic situation, and I think I was at first writing to document, because when you're living with someone who's telling you you're crazy, you start to believe it. And so there was a real desperation to what I was writing. But then I realized I was getting at a level far beyond that to process and to come to some self-knowledge and then self-acceptance.
A form of therapy.
Right, very much so.
And I appreciate that you were honest that in the beginning you really struggled with stillness and meditation, writing that I could not empty my mind. I could not sit still.
Very much so. And so the way the four steps work is the most traditional way to practice it is you find just a phrase or a sentence to read four different times with different focus. And so when you're filled with anxiety and lots of emotions and, you know, your mind's racing, to have to go back and read it again is okay. And so I could handle that level of attention at that time in my life. And the other thing I loved about it, once I learned the technique, I realized that texts could be almost anything in my life. The key was the awareness in the moment of something that like quickened my pulse or shimmered for me in some way. And often I wouldn't know why that was, but I learned to pay attention to it. And then when I would discover something like, I don't know, a piece of artwork or a novel, or I also read a lot of journalism, and something would catch me. And then I knew to kind of, you know, pin that and come back with these four steps to understand it a little better.
Yeah, I love that you talk about that it doesn't have to be scripture.
Right.
It doesn't have to be the Bible, that you say it can be fiction, poetry, music. Can you share a little bit about how that works? Because, you know, for some people that, you know, that may be more open to them.
Right, right. And I think one of the very early chapters of the book, I talked about using Lectio Divina spiritual reading with lyrics of the post-punk band Joy Division. Because in that moment of what I was going through, I connected to it. And that was the music of my youth. And as you said in the opening, I was that self-knowledge and self-acceptance. I was returning to myself. And I needed to pay attention to that. And, you know, most people are familiar with it from using its scripture if they have any familiarity with it at all. But that's why I love its flexibility. I actually have it on very good authority that you cannot do it wrong, from a Benedictine monk. So St. Benedict in the 6th century is who formalized the process. So all this time, I also have a podcast that I call Read, Pray, Write. And I like to feature authors of contemporary spiritual books, and I've had musicians, songwriters. I'm having a visual artist on at the beginning of a new season. And so I was like, oh, good, because I've been doing it this way for a while.
I think it's so true, though. I mean, I think we've all read something and you have to put the book down for a second and you're just like, oh my gosh. And it could be a character saying something to another character. And it's something that you absolutely needed to hear.
Mm-hmm. In that moment, in that place. And one of the other things that I find very interesting with it is sometimes you have to wrestle with texts. So I found a lot of accompaniment in what I was going through by going to great philosophers, great spiritual teachers that I had heard they had great reputation. But sometimes I'd read their book and like, whew, right over my head, right? I was like, I'm not seeing it. But I came back to it, and then I could understand it in that moment. I found what I needed. And we also, the practice often encourages you to, in order to stay open to mystery, to randomly select what you're going to go through the four steps with. So
that's a little wild.
Yes. Yes. And again, it's because if you're, you know, you've done it enough, you trust it. You trust that collective consciousness, the divine or your sense of God, that you, because you are beloved, that force will give you what you need in that moment.
I'm a big fan of Paulo Coelho's The Alchemist. It's a great book. And there's this line about how the universe conspires to help us find what we need. The idea that the possibility of fulfilling dreams makes life worth living. Mm-hmm. And I've always loved that. I've always thought about that. Like, if you're headed in the right direction, the universe conspires to help you. I sort of wonder if you think spiritual reading found you at the right moment.
Most definitely. As I said, at the time I learned it, I didn't know I needed it. But I was just drawn in, right? There was some aspect of it, which was the reading. And I really started, I'm from the Catholic tradition of Christianity, but I'm very much a progressive. And one of the first books I started digging into was a journalist, Dorothy Day, who is on her way to sainthood. And she was, you know, she was a founded the Catholic Worker Movement, and she had these very strident calls for social justice. And so that's how I was brought in. And then I went deeper, not only in understanding some of this philosophy and these teachings, but deeper in my prayer life, so that, you know, at first it was hard for me to be still. But, you know, with time and practice, just like anything, I could go deeper in that. So I have a range of things I use in my meditative time.
Yeah, I've never been one who can do meditation. Like, I'm too fidgety to, to sit and meditate, but I love to do it when I run. Something about, like, physically moving my body allows my brain to go off and do other things.
And the other very forgiving aspect of spiritual reading is that you develop a kindly, loving interior witness that doesn't criticize you for the fact that you're fidgety. It is okay that you have these random thoughts, and you're actually encouraged to pay attention to those thoughts. It is not, you're not doing it wrong, because the real goal is to just cultivate your awareness of the moment and the openness. So however that works, sometimes it works one way, and sometimes I very rarely am successful in getting into deep contemplation by the fourth step. And that fourth step is my favorite. It's receive. It's this idea of just sitting and listening.
When did you know this was going to be a book?
Well, so as I mentioned, writing has always been sort of a form of therapy.
You're a journalism professor.
Right. And but in a lot of ways, it's kind of an act of resistance. This whole practice became, because I was married in a relationship for very long with an unrepentant alcoholic who was also manipulative and abusive. And so this was kind of my lifeline, both the writing aspect and the spiritual reading. And so in that third step, I was writing, right? I was, and that's where the genesis of the book started. It's not where it finished. As somebody who has taught writing personal essays and columns and memoir writing, I know your first draft is for yourself. The second draft is for maybe some people close to you. And it's only the third draft. So I paid people who are much smarter than me as developmental editors. I went to a lot of workshops and really kind of changed the concept a couple of times. But the spine has always been the spiritual reading. And that's why it's even featured in my next book, and it's part of the podcast.
Oh, you have a next book.
Yes, I do indeed.
What is that?
So it's still in a proposal format, which is I'm applying this practice of deep reading or intentional reading to memoirs written by women Christian mystics.
Oh,
so
we'll have to have you back when that comes out.
Yes, and so they offer some very surprising life lessons. But if you don't do that kind of deep dive, you might miss it.
That was Jean Kelly, author of Less Helping Them, More Healing You, The Transcendental Gift of an Ancient Spiritual Practice. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Anna, this has been great. Thank you.
And where do we find your book?
Oh, as we say, where all books are sold, which means, of course, now Amazon. and then also, if anyone would like a inscribed copy straight from me, I can do that as well. And that's my website, JeanPKelly.com. And it's also on the website for my podcast, which is readpraywrite.com.
Thank you all for listening to All Sides right here on 89.7 NPR News.